It should pop right up.
Okie dokie, thanks. Well, thank you all for hanging in there to the very end, or near the end. I am actually going to sort of take our discussion down to a little bit more of a micro level. The Joint Commission is an accrediting body of healthcare systems. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing as an organization and what I've been involved in specifically to address issues related to racial and ethnic healthcare disparities, diversity, and ultimately communication in healthcare. I don't have any relationships. The work that I'm talking about was funded by the California Endowment and is being funded by the Commonwealth Fund as well. To start out, I want to make a statement that I want everybody to keep in mind throughout this presentation. Then that statement is that we all deserve to be heard. We are all healthcare consumers. We are all part of our nation's public health system. We know how important it is to be able to communicate with those who are taking care of us and to be able to give information. We talked a little bit about that importance in strategic planning at that high level, but I think it's important as we plan to really realize what it means at that patient level. So to do that, I'm going to illustrate to you and introduce, give you an illustration. And first of all, I'd like you to imagine yourself as a patient in a healthcare institution, perhaps a hospital. And knowing that it's so important for you to communicate and so important for you to have a voice in your healthcare, I want you to imagine coming out of surgery. Everybody in this audience, I assume, speaks English. We can speak pretty well. We are health literate. And I want you to imagine coming out of surgery, being in recovery, intubated, and unable to speak. And I want you to imagine how you would get the people running back and forth around you to stop and answer the question that you have. How did my surgery go? Where is my family? And when is this tube coming out of my throat? How are they doing that? And that's what I want us to think about when we think about what this, what all this strategic planning means to the ultimate recipient of our healthcare system. So to do so, I'm going to introduce you to a gentleman by the name of Juan Lopez. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about how he actually exists in the research work that we've been doing. But to start out, he is a 60-year-old Mexican immigrant. He doesn't speak any English, and he has limited experience with the United States healthcare system. He has limited acculturation, and he does, however, have a 12-year-old English-speaking daughter. And what I'm going to do is share with you what his experience was at some hospitals across the United States. And while he is a hypothetical patient, these are actual responses to some interview questions that we received during our research. So to start out, to illustrate this, Mr. Lopez actually presents to the hospital's emergency department. He's accompanied by his daughter, Juanita. He's writhing in pain, clutching his stomach. He's bent over, and he is saying, "Mi vecino me puso una brujería." He actually believes, he's saying this to the nurse, that he's in horrible pain. "Please stop this pain. My neighbor's placed a hex upon me, and I need to have this pain removed." So what we actually did when we did our research, we asked the triage nurse, "So how would you communicate with Mr. Lopez and let him know that he needs surgery?" Actually, we asked this of many people, and one example here is the response from an emergency department physician. And the response is, "First of all, I would probably use my little board or notepad, and I would write in English to see if he understands the language. If that's not the case, what I usually do is maybe by some form of sign language, try to explain to him that he has severe pain in his abdomen, and he probably needs an operation. The other thing I could do is show him maybe pictures of a surgeon where he probably has to open up the abdomen to perform the procedure." Hypothetical situation, actual response. What about the hex? This is another emergency department physician response. "We would try as best we can to dissuade him from the belief and try to make him understand his problems are real and require some kind of medical attention." So what this is meant to illustrate is the fact that we really need to begin to pay attention to this idea of communication and how effective it is in the healthcare encounter. And communication is very, very complicated. It has involved many, many players, but it's a necessary component. And it's also necessary not just in the actual communication of the language, but the communication of the message. And it's needed to be able to trust in the between a provider and a patient, and it's needed to build trust in the system. And, of course, we obviously need to do something to make some changes so that there's greater attention paid and that resources that can improve communication are actually utilized by those who need them. Some of the things that we've looked at is, in terms of looking at this and trying to better understand it, is to assess what the impact is in safety. It's communication, it's important in healthcare, but the reason that it's important is because of its impact on patient safety. We also know that there are multiple areas for vulnerability when it comes to communication, and that can have to do with being a non-English speaking individual. It also could have to do with, or might have to do with, a person's health literacy, things like that. Some examples that relate to, more specifically, to language proficiency. There are some studies that show that individuals who have language barriers are at increased risk of serious medical events. The Joint Commission actually did a study looking at, a pilot study, as a matter of fact, looking at our Sentinel event data to better understand how Sentinel events are occurring. And in 10 years of data, worth of data, reported, self-reported by accredited organizations, we found that the most common underlying root cause of Sentinel events was indeed communication. Sometimes communication is provider to provider, but also if there, it's often patient to provider. The granularity of that data is, it makes it difficult to ascertain whether or not that communication problem actually was a provider to provider communication issue or a patient to provider. But if there is a communication vulnerability, you imagine it could likely be more likely that an adverse event could occur. Also, we know that there's increased adherence to medication regimens for those who may not understand their treatment because of a language barrier. So another piece that is important here is thinking about what some of the resources are that are available to try to bridge these communication gaps. And one of the resources that is talked about a lot now is our language access services. Language access services would include interpreters, healthcare interpreters, individuals who can translate written materials, also signage that can be posted around organizations to help patients navigate the healthcare system and provide direction. What is less understood and is just becoming more apparent to the healthcare industry is that this is actually not just something that is can be done ad hoc by anyone who may be bilingual, but is indeed that requires a set of skills to interpret. There are a set of skills that are required for actually translating, because language is very, very complicated, and we're talking not just about words, but about actual meaning. Excuse me. So this quote is from a research study by Glenn Flores, where he actually looked at interpreted healthcare encounters in a pediatric setting. And he compared the encounters of a trained interpreters to those of ad hoc interpreters. Ad hoc interpreters would include anybody who's untrained or perhaps a family member. And what he actually found was that those encounters that were interpreted by an ad hoc interpreter were more likely to result in an error of serious clinical consequence. Now, the less, you know, heartening, or the rather disheartening piece of that is that the error rates were still high for those who were trained, errors of clinical consequence, but they were significantly more high or higher for those who were untrained. So, and this is actually, it was kind of one of the first studies of its kind, and there aren't a lot of studies like it because of the expense and the difficulty getting the data, but it does begin to quantify something that intuitively we understand as we think more about the intricacies of language and language access services. Okay, now to kind of go back to where Mr. Lopez came from. 5 years ago, we received a grant from the California Endowment to try to better understand how hospitals across the country were addressing issues that relate to language and culture. Specifically, this came from an interest in trying to better understand things that we thought might have an impact on racial and ethnically based healthcare disparities. And so we set out to answer three main questions. As an accrediting body, we wanted to understand what systems were in place, particularly so that we could then reflect on what our accreditation standards are. We wanted to know what the challenges were that hospitals were faced providing care to diverse populations. We wanted to know, of course, what they were doing to address those challenges. And third, we wanted to know if there were any promising practices that could be replicated across the country. So our national study was actually a qualitative study because we didn't want to just have hospitals report to us what they were doing. We wanted to go to the hospitals and talk with folks. So the quotes that I shared with you regarding Mr. Lopez are actual quotes from transcripts of clinical interviews that we conducted. You can see we sampled, we had a national sample. We really tried to target hospitals that had a variety of characteristics. Being that this was a qualitative research study, 60 hospitals was actually a lot. While our findings are not necessarily generalizable, we got a lot of really, really detailed, rich information. And we wanted to make sure that in our hospital sample, we had hospitals of differing characteristics, so the teaching, the non-teaching, the large, the small, the rural, the urban, etc. The other thing that's, that is kind of unique about our study and our study methodology is that our 60 hospital sample is actually made up of two samples. Our hospitals were identified in some cases randomly based on census data that showed differing levels of diversity, quote unquote diversity, in the region or the county that the hospital resided. So we identified these counties across the country by diversity and randomly selected hospitals within those counties. Well, partly because this was a joint commission coming out and hospitals don't want accreditors coming to their door, even though it was a research study, we had a difficult time recruiting hospitals. But in addition to wanting to get this random sampling of hospitals that were dealing with this issue, we wanted to make sure that we could answer our third research question, which was, are there any promising practices out there? So we decided to also hand select hospitals that had been identified as really doing great work in this area. We formed, as the Joint Commission often does, an advisory board, which makes the presentations today very relevant because in terms of selecting advisory boards, it's very, very important to be considerate of what sort of qualifications and experiences those advisory board members bring. But we had a national advisory board made up of about 22 different people representing a variety of organizations who are experts in the field of cultural competence, healthcare disparities, and health literacy. And they actually suggested many hospitals to us. So half of our hospitals were hospitals that were really kind of doing great, great work. We spent one day with each hospital. The day was divided between administrative interviews, which consisted of talking with folks about the hospital systems that are in place, and then the rest of the day was spent conducting clinical interviews using Mr. Juan Lopez as a proxy for an actual patient. And one of the things that that we found, and this is kind of tying this now back to strategic planning and administrative support for providing care so that the care provided at that micro level, at the patient level, is really successful, there really needs to be leadership buy-in. I'm going to share with you a framework that we put together based on some of the promising practices that we identified. And in that framework, leadership, the whole idea of leadership support is just fundamental to what is necessary in order to meet the needs, diverse needs of patients. And this, we studied hospitals, but that sort of, that concept is applicable to any type of organization. One of the things that we had the unique opportunity to do was to interview hospital CEOs. So we interviewed 59 hospital CEOs. There was one CEO at one hospital that who was not available to interview or to meet with us. And we actually were looking at those interview data to see what really drives hospital CEOs to embrace this issue, to address it. And what's interesting is they didn't tell us, oh, you know what, we have to do it because the Joint Commission says so, there are laws that say so, you know, anything like that. What they typically really responded to was to meet the needs of their patient population, which is very interesting. I mean, that's probably good. But it's interesting because they rarely relied on or related that they were using any sort of data to, you know, support what their patient needs were. Now, it doesn't mean that those data weren't being used somewhere within the organization to then inform the CEO. But I think there's some recommendations that can be made about how hospital administrators and other leaders in healthcare make use of available research and data with even within their own institutions to make important strategic decisions. Some of the things that we looked at, though, in terms of what hospitals were doing that relate to strategic planning and, you know, having sort of those structural supports in place to meet these needs, we wanted to know if hospitals had formal plans. And you look at this slide shows a breakdown between the two sample hospitals. Our stratified hospitals are those that were selected more randomly. The judgment hospitals are those that were hand-selected because they had been identified as doing really good things. And you'll see here, in terms of having formal plans to meet their cultural and linguistic needs, we broke it out by cultural needs and linguistic needs. As you can see, the judgment hospitals, not surprisingly, are a little bit ahead of the curve, or they're really incorporating this into their strategic plans. 100% of them, all of them are addressing linguistic needs. Fewer of them are addressing cultural needs. And that was a general overall finding. And I think that that's not too surprising, because what typically happens is, you know, what seems to be the case is that language needs are much more tangible than some of the cultural needs. Culture is more fluid. And this just looks at the same data compiled together, so that shows again linguistic needs are much more frequently formally addressed. One of the other things that was interesting, and all of the judgment hospitals had this, was a formal department or project office or individual who was coordinating their efforts to meet the diverse needs. If you look at the number of more randomly selected hospitals, it was only 27%. But we really see that as a key to success, is having these needs, these processes formalized. It doesn't mean one person is doing it or one department is doing it, but it means that they're coordinated. Also, of course, important is financial support, and we looked at how hospitals reported that they were meeting these needs by providing budgets. Having a specific line item was one of the questions we asked. And you see 50% of our hospitals have a specific line item for language services. Interestingly, some hospitals actually broke that out or decided not to break that out by a specific department because they found that it inhibited the use of those services. But generally, they're you know, fewer of the hospitals are not having any sort of financial support for these issues. In terms of the role of leadership, you know, again, one of the recommendations, establish a centralized program. And this information is all available in a report that we put out about a year and a half ago in April of 2007. It's available for free for download on the internet. And we actually have 32 recommendations. I'm not going to go over 32. But these are some of the ones that relate to leadership. Making this commitment visible. Again, leadership support is inherent in this, but having the leadership support visible. It doesn't necessarily mean that the hospital CEO is at every, you know, meeting to address this. But having these dialogues and supporting these internal dialogues. It was really important or interesting when we met with folks from across the organization during some of our administrative sessions to talk about this, because we were pulling together the patient safety officer along with the chief medical officer and the chief financial officer and asking questions about how they're providing language services. Those are not the kinds of questions that they're used to sitting together in a room talking about, but there were some really great aha moments during that time. And that's another one of our recommendations, to continue those dialogues. And then again, more research needed to better understand what drives CEOs, and we did that by looking more closely at our CEO data. Then there are some recommendations specific to language services. Again, the effectiveness of communication. We really, as a nation, because our population is changing rapidly, and it's changing across the country in places we wouldn't expect it. When we were recruiting hospitals, and this was about 3.5-4 years ago, you know, some of the hospitals said, "Well, you know, I'm in Vermont. This doesn't mean anything to us. This is not." Well, that's not true. Whether or not they have an influx of patients or an influx in their population that doesn't speak English, the whole idea of cultural and linguistic competence is relevant. And that's how we've sort of actually, as we've looked at this, we've seen our sort of a paradigm shift. We've gone from looking at this as something that probably addresses and relates to racial and ethnic health disparities and decided, well, maybe it does. There's not enough evidence to say so. So let's start looking at what is the common factor that really brings this home, and that's the safety issue, communication. So we're really looking at this more, it's more of a communication issue. And that's something that can impact everyone. And in order to have that buy-in, we believe that we need to make that message more clear. So that kind of leads us to our second report that we put out recently, and this has a framework where it's actually taking these concepts and some of the recommendations and putting it into a usable framework for organizations to use and to make use of when they start doing their strategic planning. Again, building on this idea that bringing people together from across the organization to have these discussions about this issue, people who aren't necessarily talking about this, can really be enlightening. And this, instead of having a report, we wanted to identify promising practices, and we did do that in the report. But instead of saying, okay, an organization should do X in order to provide better services, we recognize that what one organization was doing that may be successful is not necessarily going to be the same thing that another organization is going to need to do to be successful. It all depends on your self-assessment, your resources, your needs. So we decided that instead we pulled together all of our practices that we had deemed promising, and I won't go into the methodological way we came up with that, but we found these themes that emerged, and these are the four themes. And within building a foundation, that really has to do with your policies, your procedures, but the inherent piece of that is the support of leadership. And of course, using data and accommodating the needs and establishing internal and external collaborations. Again, kind of rolling back to this idea of collaboration in community or in strategic planning. There's a chapter in this report that actually has a self-assessment tool, and this is the tool that is made of questions. We've actually turned the information in the report around into questions so organizations can ask themselves this. And we have used it with a couple different organizations with success. We really didn't plan on putting together a self-assessment tool, so it wasn't part of our project design, but we did have the opportunity to work with some health systems for short periods of time, like 2 hours, which is not enough time, but to at least get some feedback as to how they found the questions, and they found the process of bringing people together and doing it in different ways, and received positive feedback. We actually have a survey on our website where this report, where it's downloadable, the report is also available for free and downloadable, and there's a survey there, so we are trying to seek input from organizations that are using this tool so that we can modify it in the future. And I'm running through all this because I want to give us time for questions and other panel questions. But what has kind of happened now, which is where this work is kind of turned around from research and is moving more towards policy development and then hopefully moving into practice. We received, based on the hospital's language and culture study, the research work that we did funded by the California Endowment, we just received a grant from the Commonwealth Fund to actually develop hospital accreditation standards for culturally competent patient-centered care. So this is a project that we would not have been able to do if we hadn't done the research in advance of it, and we're going to be building standards over the next 18 months to address culturally competent patient-centered care. And we've actually changed our terminology to encompass this idea of patient-centered care, so everybody sees themselves in this, as opposed to just this being a minority health issue. It's really been difficult to get the buy-in on cultural competence. I don't sense that at this conference, because I hear a lot of it. It comes up, it's a theme. But in terms of hospital administration and things like that, I think it's something that becomes lower on the priority list when we think about safety initiatives. So we'll be convening an expert advisory panel, and I'd be happy to talk to you about how we identified that panel, because we did put a call out, and we had over 700 nominations to be on that, a 15-member, well, it ends up being 25 members now, but we had, it was a great testament to the interest in this work. So we'll be having an advisory panel will be working with us, and we're working with the National Health Law Program to not only help us and advise us as we develop standards, but also to develop an implementation guide. So it'll probably be sort of like a bigger and better, above and beyond, one size doesn't fit all sort of report. That's just a repeat. So just to end, this is if any of you haven't read this book, I highly recommend it, The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down by Anne Fadiman. And it really speaks to the health system challenges that are plagued in our country's health system related to meeting needs of diverse patient populations and the role that culture can play specifically in the effectiveness of communication. If you have any interest in more information, the reports are all available for free. We have lots of resources, and my contact information is there. I thank you so much.
Amy, do you have a question?
A couple slides back, you talked about cultural and linguistic competence, but the recommendations there were all linguistic. And can you speak a little bit about the cultural? That I think, is much more difficult than the linguistic.
Yeah, actually, you know what, that's a very, very good point. And I think in the framework, in the one size report, culture is integrated more comprehensively than in the recommendations from our first report. The one thing I didn't identify, we had a research framework that we modeled our site visits from. And there were six domains. There was leadership, quality improvement and data use, workforce, patient safety and provision of care. There was a domain for language services, and there was a domain for community engagement. Within each of those domains were some of sort of what we saw as structural supports for addressing cultural issues. And we did a lot of, you know, noticed in the when the data were reported, we sort of tagged out or culled out culture, like how are you addressing cultural issues? And really, because I think culture is so fluid, there were fewer formal processes for addressing culture. One of the things that we make recommendations for to address that is, one, of course, make use of the resources that you have available. And I think the tool that we designed is to help organizations identify and become aware of the resources that they have. Partly to raise awareness that culture even plays a role in, you know, the healthcare encounter and the communication, because particularly when we did the clinical interviews, I mean, it was really interesting. We actually did a site visit to sit down with the administrators and hear, this is what we have, these are our systems that are in place. Then to go onto the units, go walk through the emergency department, speak with the triage nurse, go to radiology, talk to the tech, go up on the floor and talk to them, and see how these things actually work in practice or don't work. And you know, with our hypothetical patient, we used the idea of, for him, his cultural belief was that he had the hex. And one of the things that we're looking at specifically now, the data are, are analyzed, but looking at how the direct care staff responded to this idea that he had a hex. He was sent for psychiatric evaluation a lot, and he was also the one quote said, we tried to dissuade him from this belief, tell him that that's a lot more often. The responses were, well, I don't know. Maybe that's a cultural issue. Maybe I'll call the chaplain. Maybe the interpreter can help me navigate this. Some fewer organizations had structures such as cultural brokers that they could turn to. More frequently, it was the interpreter. But the interpreters, the chaplains, and with the few hospitals that had them, cultural brokers were resources that were available. So I think if you look at the full 32 recommendations in that report, there are some that speak to the cultural piece.
Did you see certain areas of the country that were more culturally competent than others?
You know, that's really interesting because we oversampled in California, and California, I think, as a state, generally is considered to be ahead of the curve, and I think it is, but it doesn't mean that there aren't still challenges. Some hospitals in states that historically are quote-unquote diverse, particularly with language issues, again, the more tangible piece, those were the hospitals that when we talked with them, they said, oh, we don't have a problem. This is fine here because, you know what, we have so many bilingual staff. The people that serve our patients are the ones that grew up here. It's not a problem. So they are operating where they were 30 years ago when this was still an issue. But in the last decade, so much has done in terms of professionalizing the language access services that are and what's going on there. So they don't have that realization. So I almost dare say that organizations that are faced with this for the first time are in a better position to actually meet their needs because they have more resources available to them. Not that it's not easy. It's definitely challenging.
They have a different
perspective. Yeah.
They don't think they already know the answer.
Exactly. And I would, in terms of the hospitals that when we were not giving any of the hospitals we visited a score. We were just, tell us what you were doing. But, you know, you go to I did 30 of the site visits and my colleague did the other 30. And I can remember certain hospitals that I walk out of thinking, wow, they really got it. And I can't say this definitively, but I bet you every single one of those hospitals, the person who was either leading it or the CEO told me, oh, we're not even beginning to meet all the needs. The hospitals that said, oh, you know what, this isn't a problem, we've got great services, da-da-da-da, were the ones who are like, boy, they have a lot of holes. So I forget, one of your presentations mentioned the idea that it's a journey, it's not a destination or something to that effect, and I think that's the message that really needs to be, you know, put forward in all of this in terms of strategic planning for any initiative or whatever, but thinking about diversity because you're going to constantly, your diversity is going to constantly change. So, yeah. Sure. And there's actually a lot of work going on. There's a National Coordinating Council for Certification of Healthcare Interpreters, and it's being convened by the National Council on Interpreting in Healthcare and several other interpreter organizations to come up with a certification program. In terms of, I think there are right now a lot of organizations, when we visited them, said, well, we have a 40-hour course. There are a lot, and that's good. We don't have national certification yet. I don't know that if we were to say what the ideal is, if we have the resource capacity in terms of individuals who could meet the ideal. So there are some concerns there. But so I don't have a definite answer for you. My answer to that is kind of goes back to looking at the resources that are available to make sure that, you know, there's a method to continually assess competency among those who are serving in that capacity. The other thing that I think is often part of a successful language access program in an organization is that they don't rely on just one type of language access service. So for example, 59 of the hospitals we visited had access to the telephone interpreter. They all had, and the only one that didn't was an Indian Health Service hospital, and they served the Navajo population, that, and it just wouldn't have been worth or useful to them. But when we talked to the clinical staff, one of the, even though that resource was always available, it was less often used. And I think thinking about the training, not only of the interpreter, the individuals interpreting, but the training of those who are supposed to be using the interpreter. And also, we make a lot of, we push a lot for, you know, using interpreter and language services because it's the patient's right, the patient needs this. That's, yes, that's true, but I think we less often emphasize that the provider needs it. Your institution needs this. What about when these folks are getting bills from your institution also, and if they don't read, if they don't understand English, how it's less likely that they're going to actually pay their bills. So some of the things that have, like practices that came up, relate not just to actual language access and addressing those specific cultural pieces, but are more practical approaches to getting paid, things like that. So I know I kind of didn't exactly answer your question, but I think that, you know, there isn't a gold standard for interpreting, but I think there's work being done to go there. And there are two reports out that are available on the National Council's website from the Coordinating Council about talking about certification. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you all again for coming.
Thank you.